There are a whole lot of economic what-ifs out there right now, and with what-ifs comes uncertainty, and everybody hates that. The Brits in the EU, Americans in this election, we got it all from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Tuesday, the 14th of June. Glad to have you along, as always, everybody. We are going to get to some of the aftermath of Orlando a little bit later on in the program today. But to begin with, two words, Brexit and uncertainty. And yes, I know Brexit isn't really a word, but if you're looking for a driver of the global economy right now, that would be it. Amid increasing signs that the Leave vote is ahead, and yes, I know polls are fallible, but amid those signs, nonetheless, uncertainty does seem to be rearing its ugly economic head. June 23rd is the vote. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman from our desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting is our reporter on the story.
Even the prospect of Britain leaving the EU is already causing anxiety.
We've seen huge fluctuations in the British pound right now. The financial markets, of course, don't like change, and they don't like uncertainty.
My market expert here is Debbie McCall, who owns the Scottish Country Shop in Portland, so she's got a very ground-level view of U.S.-British trade relations. She says the British pound hasn't been this weak against the dollar since she opened in 2003.
So at the moment, really great deal for Americans on Walker's shortbreads, right?
Yeah, we pass on savings as soon as we can.
Yeah, but maybe not such a great bargain for the U.S. if there's an actual Brexit, with currencies and markets in flux for a while, trade treaties having to be renegotiated. Analyst John D. Clue at U.S. Bank Wealth Management says a British vote against increasing global economic integration might undermine pending free trade deals with America's European and Asian Pacific trading partners.
It casts a pall on very important efforts to reduce trade barriers and tariffs, and so now you have another problem with global growth.
Brexit would also be a headache for U.S. companies, says Tamim Bayoumi at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
U.S. multinationals, for example, which had manufacturing in, let's say, the U.K., might find it much more difficult to export to the European Union.
Bayoumi says the long-term danger to the U.S. might be disintegration of the EU itself if other countries also head for the exits. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, speaking of heading for the exits, it was all Brexit all the time. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're going to pick up now with the series that we're running this week, The Price of Profits, it's called. What happens when companies decide that creating this thing called shareholder value ought to be at the top of their list of things to do? As always, in business and economic reporting, as in life, a little context is helpful. Marketplace's Scott Tong has it.
It all began with a professor at the University of Chicago. Economist Milton Friedman wrote this in 1970. There is one and only one social responsibility of business, to increase its profits. For whom? For stockholders, he wrote. This was a brand new idea that took, because the old corporate model was crumbling under pressure from inflation and from weak growth. Rick Wortsman of the Drucker Institute is the author of The End of Loyalty, coming out this year.
Some called it slumpflation. Inflump was another one that circulated. But most famously was stagflation.
It exposed American companies as uncompetitive.
Many companies had gotten fat and lazy during the golden age of American business. We just didn't see the seams starting to come apart until the late 60s, early 70s.
Friedman and his Chicago colleagues argued that companies were taking on too many social responsibilities, providing jobs, helping to fight pollution, and end discrimination. It was inefficient.
We saw enormous amounts of waste going on.
Economist Mike Jensen was a student of Friedman's, and he co-wrote the most cited business paper ever. Shareholders suffered, he wrote, because executives were selfish. They wanted perks.
You can't ignore the self-interest of everybody that's involved, and you can't assume that firms maximize profits.
CEOs feathering their nests. Now, some of us of a certain vintage recall the 80s film Wall Street. It stars a rather obnoxious shareholder, Gordon Gekko, here talking to other shareholders.
You are all being royally screwed over by these bureaucrats with their steak lunches, their hunting and fishing trips, their corporate jets and golden parachutes.
Now, if you listen closely, Gordon Gekko was channeling his inner University of Chicago Mike Jensen. If you shape up executives, you shape up companies, and shareholders win.
Quite often, something that's significantly new and right, or basically right, is rejected by the profession because it's too new. But that all went away eventually. It caught on. It stuck.
Jensen went on to become a superstar prof at Harvard Business School, where his ideas went mainstream. David Langstaff was an MBA student then, before going on to run companies in national defense.
The dominant and the accepted understanding at the time, which continues, is that business is there to make a profit for shareholders, period.
So, into the 80s echo chamber, along with big hair and new Coke, went three business words.
Maximize shareholder value.
Mike Jensen may not have used those words, but that's how his ideas got applied by a whole generation of leaders, says Roger Martin. He's former management dean at the University of Toronto.
There was an obsession with shareholder value maximization as manifested in meeting your quarterly earnings so the analysts are all happy with you.
How happy? Stocks soared 12-fold in the 80s and 90s. For every $1 in profits, 80 cents went to shareholders through dividends and what are called buybacks. Which brings us to the rub. A fast way to fast profits is cutting jobs. Rick Wortsman of the Drucker Institute says what began to erode at this time is what he calls the corporate social contract.
That basically said, if you come to work every day and you work hard and you give the corporation a measure of loyalty, we in turn will take care of you, often for the rest of your life. All that changed.
Wages flattened. Pensions and healthcare benefits eroded.
This idea of maximizing shareholder value is an important reason why all that happened. There are other reasons. The rise of technology, globalization, the decline of unions. But I'd put it right up there with any of those other factors.
To many, the relevant case study here is General Electric in the 1980s, run by an old college hockey captain named Jack Welch. Now, GE in the 50s, like many companies then, made explicit that workers and research came first, shareholders last. But under Welch, it downsized more than 100,000 workers in 5 years, one of his strategies being to dump the lowest 10% of performers. Here's Welch at the MIT Sloan School of Business in 2005.
Okay, you know exactly who the turkeys are. And they're right amongst you. Baseball teams do it every day. It's the way it is. Why should business not have cuts?
Welch cut entire divisions and plants. He famously demanded that his managers fix it, sell it, or close it.
A lot of people initially were a little bit alarmed.
Nicholas Heyman of the investment bank William Blair is a long, long-time GE analyst, going all the way back to the 80s. He spoke by phone.
GE's actions spawned a lot more similar type of aggressive cost restructuring across industrial America in the late 80s and throughout the 90s.
Fair or not, Welch became the face of maximizing shareholder value, its winners and its losers. In his 2 decades at the helm, GE met Wall Street expectations almost every single quarter. A $14 billion company became a more than $400 billion behemoth. Welch himself made nearly $1 billion. So other executives followed, sometimes to be like him and sometimes out of fear. Because in the mid-80s, some testy shareholders with deep pockets started to buy out big companies and fire underperforming executives. There's accountability.
Another one bites the dust, and another one goes.
This all took on different names, from corporate raiders to today's activist investors. Perhaps the most famous being Carl Icahn. Hedge fund manager Jeff Graham has written a book on these battles. It's called Dear Chairman.
If you're the CEO of a company, then you have to keep that stock up. There's a famous quote from Carl Icahn from the 1980s. You need to keep that stock up or someone will do it for you.
Shareholders first. It became gospel. But the question is it even in the scripture? Does the law require it? Cornell law professor Lynn Stout is the author of The Shareholder Value Myth.
there is a widespread and completely erroneous belief out there that there's some sort of legal duty that corporate managers have to, quote, maximize profits or maximize shareholder value.
In Stout's view, the misplaced assumption comes from an old, old case that cites stockholders' interest. But to stay out of the weeds here, she argues it did not set precedent. By contrast,
you can just pick up the Supreme Court case Hobby Lobby decided just a few years ago, read the majority opinion where Justice Alito says, and I quote, modern corporate law does not require for-profit corporations to pursue profit at the expense of everything else.
Now, just to be clear, law professors still argue about this. But the point is, it's far from a legal given that companies have to make profits for shareholders. And yet, it became the law of the land. And to Stout, it led directly to some bad decisions. Enron, the BP oil spill, the financial crisis. Which brings us back to the man widely acclaimed as the intellectual father, Mike Jensen.
Is it happened exactly the way I wanted it to happen? Probably not.
Jensen says the shareholder focus in some cases went overboard.
And there's always going to be some people who take it too far and then cause damage.
He says focusing only on stocks and stockholders is a misreading of his scholarship. For the record, he wrote in 1990 that CEOs should, quote, do what is in the shareholder's best interest. Now, he says,
I wouldn't put shareholders at the center. I'm still unhappy about the situation where people end up thinking that shareholders are primary. They're our only bosses. No.
Still, maximizing shareholder value remains in fashion. In one study of the S&P 500 companies, the share of profits going to stockholders has gone from 50% in the early 80s to 86% in 2013, leaving an ever-shrinking pool of money to invest in the businesses themselves. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
If you didn't check it out yesterday, or actually, even if you did, we've got some new stuff up online for our series. It's at priceofprofits.org. Coming up.
If you have cash on hand and you want to grow, what are the other options? Well, buying growth can help.
The rise and then the fall of conglomerates. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials fell today 57 points, about a 3%, closed at 17,674, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ off 4 points, about a 10%, 4843. The S&P 500 down 3 points, a 10%, 2075. Big credit card issuer Synchronicity Financial issued a warning about consumer defaults. Its shares off 13% today. Whoa. American Express charged down 4%. A panel of federal judges upheld the government's net neutrality rules today, handing a big victory to the Obama administration and lots of other big names. Verizon up 0.75%. AT&T up about 0.5% today. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note, pretty much flat, 1.61%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As we all knew would happen, the shootings in Orlando Sunday morning became very political very quickly. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump each made speeches about it yesterday and about terrorism as well. Mr. Trump specifically restating his plan to ban Muslim entry into the United States if he wins the election. Today, President Obama weighed in as well.
We hear language that singles out immigrants and suggests entire religious communities are complicit in violence.
If you see the videotape, you can see the president is clearly angry. But Donald Trump is now the presumptive Republican nominee for that office, with what have to be treated as serious policy proposals worthy of and ready for close inspection. So were he to take office, what would a ban on Muslims mean for the American economy? From New York, Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that one.
According to the U.S. National Travel and Tourism Office, 1.2 million human beings visited the U.S. from the Middle East in 2013, and they spent collectively $6.7 billion. So that's $6.7 billion you can subtract from the U.S. economy right there. Now, of course, the Middle East does not have the majority of the world's Muslims. The majority are in Asia, Southeast Asia, and Africa. Add them in, and the number's closer to $18 billion. And that is just tourism. There's education, of course. Trump's plan would ban, at a minimum, the 154,000 students from majority Muslim countries who came here in 2015.
All international students, including those from Muslim countries, bring billions of dollars in revenue and support hundreds of thousands of jobs in the U.S. when they come for higher education.
Rajika Pandari is with the Institute of International Education. Take those 154,000 students, multiply by average tuition, and you get another $5 billion you can subtract from the U.S. economy. We can throw in another billion from Muslim students from India. In any case, our grand back-of-the-envelope estimate so far is $24 billion. That's not counting, by the way, contributions from all the Muslims on work visas with jobs in Silicon Valley and elsewhere. All of this is the cheapest part of the cost.
The first and foremost cost is it's going to flush the Bill of Rights on day one of any potential Trump presidency.
Corey Saylor is with the Council on American Islamic Relations. He says there's a cost to America's brand as well.
We will fall right off the stage as the leader of the free world.
The ban would bar Muslim doctors serving rural communities. It would ban the extensively vetted Muslim refugees fleeing ISIS. It would ban Muslims like the ones who prayed in Central Park on Sunday for the victims of the Orlando shooting. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
In a way, the news of the day today is a little bit about culture, right? The Brits and the EU, the prospect of banning a religious group from this country. We're going to turn back now to our series on shareholder value and the culture of Wall Street and what happened there that made profits the be-all and end-all. Karen Ho is an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Minnesota. She has spent years studying Wall Street, even worked there for a while herself. So the logical first question was, what's it like on the inside?
It's really a huge industry with multiple institutions, actors, networks, right, from private equity firms to Wall Street investment bankers to hedge funds. And it's they undergo a intense socialization process whereby they're sort of cultivated and they come to understand themselves as the smartest guys in the room. Hmm. So the larger institutional culture in which they're embedded, on the one hand, they constantly recite the mantra of shareholder value. On the other hand, they're socialized into the context where they experience sort of a constant expiration date to their own jobs. The sort of, I'll be gone, you'll be gone, YBG, IBG.
Really? They have it acronymized?
It is acronymized. Wow. And then the third layer is that they're paid mainly on their bonus compensation. They're paid mainly on the number of deals they're able to push through, the number of deals they're able to execute, and not on the quality of their deals. So if you're compensated based on the quantity of deals, and you're not going to be at your job for very long,
yeah,
and you understand yourself to be the smartest guy in the room and legitimated as a global advisor, It's not surprisingly that your strategy is to ride the wave as long as you can, and in a sense, to not have a long-term outlook.
One would have thought that if anything was going to cure Wall Street and the financial system in this country of short-termism, as you describe, it would have been the financial crisis of 2008. And yet, I'm not sure we're seeing that.
Major Wall Street's financial institutions recognized that precisely because average Americans were the ones holding pension funds and retirement accounts and mutual funds and money market accounts, that kind of global interconnection helped to shape their bailout, helped to demand their bailout. Hmm. And so what I would argue is that the bailout also bailed out these problematic cultural practices.
Is there a way that the short-termism of the shareholder value mantra that exists today, is there a way that that changes?
There are bigger steps and smaller steps that one can take. And one is certainly to really sort of rechange the policy landscape so that Wall Street financiers and investors are actually measured by what happens 5 to 7 years from now, as opposed to yearly or quarterly bonuses. So that's, in a sense, something that I think many sides can come to the table on.
Karen Ho is a professor of anthropology at the University of Minnesota. Karen, thanks very much.
Thanks so much, Kai.
grow or else. Bigger is better. More, more, more. That is the mantra of corporate America, right? The answer is, yeah, mostly that's right. But today's big is nothing like the big of 50 years ago. At least today's big conglomerates make some sense, synergy-wise. Think Disney owning Pixar, for instance. But if you think back, you realize quickly that bigger hasn't always been better. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner wraps up our series, The Price of Profits, for today.
Imagine a company that began by making car bumpers, buying a Hollywood movie studio. Crazy, right? But that's how a corporation called Gulf and Western started in the late 1950s. Over the next few decades, Gulf and Western bought not only Paramount Studios, but companies that mined zinc, grew sugar, made chemicals, cigars, R&B records, mattresses, and caskets. And why not throw in a beauty pageant, too?
We have Miss Italy, we have Miss Puerto Rico, and we have Miss Philippines!
So what did Miss Universe have to do with auto parts? Nothing. But antitrust law made it hard to buy companies in your own industry, says Jerry Davis, author of The Vanishing American Corporation.
And so if you have cash on hand and you want to grow, what are the other options? Well, buying growth can help.
There were personal incentives to buy growth, too. In those days, CEO salaries were often tied more to the size of a company than to its performance.
And so you could arguably raise your salary by making the company really big.
And snag a spot on the coveted Fortune 500, a ranking of companies solely by total revenues. New York-based money manager Mario Gabelli analyzed conglomerates at his first Wall Street job in the 1960s.
You basically bought a company, your stock was at 10 times cash flow, you bought somebody at 4 times cash flow, you immediately added to your earnings, the street loved you, you would report higher earnings, and your stock would go up.
Which allowed you to buy more companies. Armed with a high stock price and the magic of accounting, conglomerates became the hottest stocks of the 1960s. Jeffrey Madrick is author of The Age of Greed.
It was another example of Wall Street fooling itself and fooling its investors. They bought the myth.
The myth, Madrick argues, was synergy, that somehow the acquired companies would grow much faster together under the eye of one hard-charging CEO, like Charles Bluedorn at Gulf and Western. He knew nothing about filmmaking, but meddled anyway in Paramount classics like The Godfather.
These people had immense egos and immense ambition, and they could use the financial system to develop their little companies into giants with enormous power.
But when profits and the stock market began to fall in the late 60s, the conglomerates were exposed. As the economy weakened, it became clear to Wall Street that these once powerful companies were built more on clever accounting than dynamic businesses. James Schrager at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business says Wall Street adopted a new mantra, focus equals power.
And the conglomerates famously had no focus.
Frustrated investors knew the conglomerates' parts were worth more than the whole. They pushed CEOs and boards to raise stock prices. The corporate raiders of the 80s weren't subtle about it. They staged hostile takeovers of undervalued companies, sold off assets, and reaped the profits.
There's just never been anything like it in American history. A third of the biggest corporations disappearing, mostly due to hostile takeovers, very often of conglomerates.
Some conglomerates broke themselves up before somebody else did. In the early 80s, Bluedorn's successor sold off more than 50 companies and restructured Gulf and Western into the more narrowly focused Paramount Communications. CEO Martin Davis told Wall Street his main purpose was to, quote, produce the greatest possible value to shareholders. When Davis eventually sold the company, Viacom bid well over 4 times the value of Gulf and Western a decade earlier. It was an offer the shareholders couldn't refuse. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, I don't know that there's been a less anticipated meeting of the Federal Open Market Committee since way back in the Bernanke days. Brexit, the lousy jobs report, you know the drill as well as I do. That said, I'm obliged by the Business Journalist Code of Conduct to mention that Chair Yellen et al. Are indeed meeting today and tomorrow. Interestingly enough, 6% of economists surveyed by the Wall Street Journal think the Fed is going to raise rates. Yeah, I don't know what they're thinking either. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 57 points today, about a 1/3%. The Nasdaq down 4 points, about a 1/10%. The S&P 500, 3 points off, a 1/10%. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kurwa, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.